My name is Michael Pellet, and I am pastor of King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada.
Wow.
Woo! It's even worse. And I also teach at the Catholic College at the University of Saskatchewan, St. Thomas More College, where my chief areas of teaching are philosophy of religion, and most particularly philosophical and phenomenological hermeneutics. I'll be happy to talk to any of you about phenomenology and hermeneutics, but I'm sure you'll all be hiking by then. This week we are going to try and look at Romans chapter 7 and 8, both an anti-theme and theme in terms of Holden's theme for the year. All the promises of God are yes, because we'll be starting out in Romans 7 with some no's. And I'll be joined for the first 2 days with my friend, Wretched I. And so we will, for the first 2 days, try to make your times here miserable. We know that all of you come to Holden Village, wretched people that you are, to be wretched and miserable. And my goal for the first 2 days is to make that as truthful as possible. So we'll begin with Romans chapter 7 and 8. And again, today what I would like to, the key passages that I'll be looking at are Romans chapter 7, verses 7 to 12. And I'll read those for you in a moment, but you may want to turn there. And as we begin, I want to note that this section in Romans is, in terms of a rhetorical style, or a style of communicating, is what's known as a diatribe. And Paul is giving us a diatribe, both in particularly chapter 7, but also in chapter 8. The diatribe was a rhetorical style that was used by religious orators and some philosophers. It's dialogical in form. So what we have here in Romans chapter 7 and 8 is a dialogue. And what we have in the diatribe is where the speaker employs the second person pronoun, you, addressing that you, who would be, in this sense, the reader or the audience, as if they were an adversary who is interrogated or who is allowed to raise objections. And so here in our diatribe, you kind of have Paul and Wretched I going at it. And again, the speaker makes this supposed person ask questions. And usually the questions there are kind of set up questions. And so this speaker asks stupid questions, because after all, the audience, or if it's a philosopher, you have the teacher and the disciple, the basic assumption is that, of course, all of you out there are fools and you are stupid. So, that is your position, okay? Are you miserable yet? It gets worse. The speaker answers these questions, often often by means of a counter question. And the speaker often feigns astonishment or indignation at the questions that were answered. So that you miserable people will ask this question and I go, how can you be so stupid? And then I continue on to enlighten you, which is, of course, what you're all here for. The response is often ironic in mode. Sometimes the effect of this kind of diatribe is to reduce the questioner, or again, that one who is the stupid one, to silence. I hope that won't happen. This style is nervous, quick, fast-paced, with ideas and motifs quickly arising. And so as you read Romans 7 and 8, Paul is just pop, here's an idea, here's an idea, pop, 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 pop. We've got all sorts of themes all over the place. And the style is chosen for its effect. It is hoped that by using the diatribe style, one can preserve the questioner or the student from error and to bring one to understanding. And so that's what Paul is hoping to do here in Romans 7 and 8. The diatribe that we have in our section today is that, again, there is first a short question followed by a second longer question. Then there's a short answer, which is often, again, this emotive answer of astonishment. And then that is followed by a longer answer, and then comes an explanation. And so if we want to see it in a nice little outline form, the diatribe that we have here, starting the very first line of verse 7, we have our stupid questioner. There's the short question, the longer question, then comes the short answer, then the longer answer, and then the explanation. And then in the next section, which we'll do tomorrow, again, we have another diatribe that's here. But so this is the diatribe style and format for today and what we're going to take a look at. And so Romans 7, 7 through 12. And you can follow along in your Bibles, please. I'll give you my translation of this section from Romans. And again, the first two questions are asked by the questioner. So it's what then should we say? That the law is sin? An intolerable thought! Yet, if it had not been through law, I would not have known the sin. Indeed, I would not know what it is to covet if the law did not say, you shall not covet. But sin, seizing a base of operations activated in me by means of the commandment, all kinds of covetousness. For separated from law, sin is lifeless. And I was living once, separated. But when the commandment came, sin came to life again. But I died. And it was discovered the commandment which was to be life, this same commandment led me into death. For sin, seizing a base of operations, deceived me by means of the commandment, and through it killed me. Whereas, on the one hand, the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and just and good. Thus ends the reading. And as you know, it kind of ends mid-air. And we'll talk about that too. All right. So what is Paul trying to get at here in this section? And that's what we'll spend a little time trying to think our way through. First of all, the whole notion of law and what Paul is talking about when he's talking about law. And again, it has different nuances. But in general, in Romans, when Paul talks about law, he takes the etymological meaning of the Greek term nomos seriously. Nomos is derived from nemo, which means literally to divide or to attribute or attribute parts. Greek word for law is nomos, literally. That means to divide or to divide into parts. And when you think of the law and indeed how it operates, that's what it always does. I mean, you know, you go to court and the law is applied and you're either going to be guilty or not guilty. You're going to divide it. You've got a law, you've got the speed limit. You either keep the speed limit or you break the speed limit. The law always divides and it attributes into parts. Or, you know, again, the law, you have at 18, you are an adult. Under 18, you're not an adult. Now, whether that's true in your particular instance or not, I don't care. The law divides it that way. Right? So that's how law works. And of course, according to Paul, we recognize this, how the law also works. And most particularly, coming out of the Jewish context, what the law did was it divided or it separated God's chosen people from all the others. And so therefore you have the Jews, the chosen, and the Gentiles, either the nations, the goyim, the ethnos, however you want to do that. But it was the law that made that demarcation. And again, one would say, well, that's good. Or is it? Right? That's the whole beginning of the question there, right? Is the law sin? Because sometimes that dividing doesn't seem to work out so well. So, for Paul, again, Paul starts reflecting upon the law by noting how law operates, primarily in instituting divisions and separations. And in this section, in Romans 7 and 8, the key separation that we're going to have here is sarx, or flesh, and pneuma, spirit. And so one of the things we, again, will need to keep in mind throughout is, what is this flesh-spirit division? vision that Paul understands. Again, the way the law functions to divide in this section of Romans is also within each person. We are divided within ourselves and at conflict with ourselves. We'll talk about that more tomorrow. Key passages here that talk about this division within ourselves is chapter 7, verse 19, and again in verse 23. So, given that, and given how the law works, how it divides, right? Our interlocutor, the stupid one, then said, what are we to say to this, that the law is sin? And of course, Paul's short answer is meganoito, usually translated by no means. I want to kind of up that a little. That's a pretty emotive saying, but I think it's, you know, it's an intolerable thought. It is unthinkable that the law could be sin. So that's not the case. So if that's how it works, then we get the longer answer. And that's the rest there of verse 7. He said, yet if it had not been through the law, I would have not known, or not through law, I would not have known the sin. Then he says, I would not know what it is to covet if the law did not say, you shall not covet. Now the interesting thing about this, in this section, and again, right, reading Greek is always nice for all of this, is that Paul switches back and forth between putting a definite article in front of him. Sometimes he'll go, the sin, sometimes he'll say, the law, at other times he'll just say, sin, or just say, law. And so, at both times, it means it's a sense of universal. At other times, it has a sense of particularity or specificity. And so, what he's trying to get at here and getting us to think about, on the one hand, sin or law are universal. Conceptually, we can understand them in general, universal ways. On the other hand, as they work in us, as it is activated in us, it always takes on a particular kind of specificity. So that, in other words, in any particular experience or given situation, the law may work on you differently than it will work on me. Or sin may work on you differently than it will work on me. It's still all law and it's still all sin, but right, each of us have our own specific and particular ways in which that is experienced and in which law and sin carry themselves out. The other thing in these two clauses, right? If it had not been through law, I would not have known the sin. For all you grammarians, that clause is a past condition contrary to fact. The next line, I would not know what it is to covet if the law did not say, that's a present condition contrary to fact. Now, right, why, who cares about that? Well, I don't. What it suggests here is the notion of learning is past. The resulting knowing, that is our experiential knowledge, our practical living, is not merely intellectual, but is present and ongoing. So in other words, right, we've got, as the law would do in this division here, the learning is past. Just like probably way back when somewhere, you learned your ABCs. But the knowing is present and ongoing, and therefore experienced. So in other words, knowing your ABCs means you still practice that, and that's still ongoing. So if I ask you to look up the word phenomenological in the dictionary, you'll start going, let's see, oh, there it's P, right? So you'll sing your little song in that. Your knowing is still present and ongoing. Come on, right? We all know. You still, when you look up the word in the dictionary, you sing a little song. Right? Even us pre-Sesame Street folks do that. In other words, the knowing that Paul is talking about is experiential. This is not simply an intellectual exercise. You say, oh yes, I know how the law works. Right? And then I can write a nice treatise on law. This is, I experience, I live law working in my life. And the way I experience and understand how the law works is particularly in terms of the commandment, you shall not covet. Now, why did Paul pick that commandment? How many commandments did Paul have to choose from? How many? Ten. No. How many commandments did he have to choose from? 600?
32.
640.
613.
613.
Right? Second Temple Judaism with the Pharisees and all of that, and that's in Paul's time, they read through the entire Hebrew scriptures, the Torah, and when they counted up all the commands in the Torah, there were 613 of them, of which indeed we kind of focus on 10. But for a Pharisee, for a pious keeper of the law, all 613 were important, not just the 10. Those 10 words were no more important or less important than the other 603 that would have gone with them. The other interesting thing, and this is a little numerology in terms of 613, the rabbis understood that if you take from their understanding all the days that are there in the year and all the bones that comprise your body, you end up with 613. Now that's really important. No, come on, don't laugh. How can you be so stupid? Right? Every day of the year is under God's law. Every bone in your body should strive to keep Torah. What better way of understanding, loving the Lord your God with all your heart and strength and soul and might? Every day with every bone you've got. Right? That's what the law is, right? That's why Paul knows.
Thank God for leap years.
They didn't have one. So. Right, but that's a good point, Jonathan. It's also the problem with the year zero, but we won't go there. So why covet all of these laws? Why is he pulling out covet? And the other thing is, he just says, right, thou shalt not covet. But is that what that command says?
Your what? Neighbor's wife, property.
Right, I mean, for within our Lutheran tradition, right, coveting includes both the ninth and the tenth commandment. And coveting, of course, always had an object. Your neighbor's manservant, maidservant, oxen, cattle, wife, all of these things. It had an object. Paul even drops off the object. He's just happy with don't covet. Now, why that? Couple ways of looking at that. First, again, in terms of the Jewish tradition. And within the Jewish tradition, again, at Paul's time, it is the understanding that coveting, or we could say another name for that, I'll give you the Greek. Epithymia is often translated as desire or covet. So coveting is desire. So another way, perhaps a more colloquial way of translating this commandment is simply don't desire. And here again, it was understood within the Jewish tradition that desire is the beginning of all sin. Desire is the root and source of all sins. In other words, the origin of sin is an inner reality. That it is within the human heart. And the key passage for that, that again the rabbis look at closely, is Genesis 3, chapter 6. If someone would turn to Genesis 3, 6, please, and read it for us.
So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate.
Good. Thanks, John. Right. See the desire? Saw that it was good, right? I mean, often desire is seen through the eye. Whoa, that looks good. The brownies on the other table. Look a lot better than the brownies. there were more of them, so that I saw that they were good, and they were a delight to my eyes, and that they were to be desired. And so I took and ate. And tough luck for you guys that ended up one brownie short. Right? That's how the rabbis here are thinking. Note, saw it was good, delight it was to be desired. And it is from that inner sense of desire that all now, if you will, the more outward and external sins happen, like eating the fruit, or lying to God, or being embarrassed and ashamed and foolishly making fig leaf aprons for themselves.
Michael, could you say it's the distinction between what you want and what you need, too? Desire is what you want. Huh?
It's even, the thing is that desire is what you want, but part of what you want is also what you need. The understanding here would be that in desire would include both your wants and your needs. So that I need to eat, right? But that's also a desire, a law. But as well, I might want
the bigger steak. Brownie.
The bigger brownie, yeah. And a steak. That kind of thing. Right. Okay, moving on. Covet also fits the issue that we'll take up tomorrow in verses 14 to 25 about, again, Paul desiring, wanting to do the good, but doesn't. Whereas again, the other, if you will, nine words of the Decalogue don't quite fit. It's not like, you know, I desire to steal, but I don't steal, or I don't want to steal, but I do steal. No, it's all this sense about desiring, coveting, that Paul carries on in the next section. As well, Paul will recognize that most people will claim to outwardly observe most commandments. And certainly Paul would see this for himself, right? He does not abuse God's name. He honors his father and mother, does not commit murder, adultery, theft. So, you know, in that sense, externally, outwardly, he keeps all those commandments. One could say, you know, we keep the, you know, anybody murder anybody yet this morning? Okay, well, good for you. You're off to a good start. Right? But as soon as you do that, now we're back into the realm of desire, aren't we? I wish you were dead.
Yeah.
Right? That kind of thing. And so, again, it is our inner desires or our secret cravings that Paul is talking about here. Again, later in theology, you have to give this a fancy term. It's called concupiscence.
Whoa.
Yeah. Right. And certainly from Augustine onward, medieval theology, Luther, Lutheran confessions, the other confessions of different Christian traditions at that time, they all talk about concupiscence.
As in Cupid.
Huh?
As in Cupid.
As in Cupid. cupiditas as opposed to caritas, for all you Latinates, right? Caritas, charity, love. Cupiditas, Cupid is again a love, but it is that craving, that desire, that kind of inappropriate love and concupiscence that is going on there. So again, Paul is talking about that kind of thing. And how indeed desire can control or be a tyrant in our lives. Again, a secular example and a philosophical example. This comes from Plato's Republic. And Plato is talking about how we govern our soul. And again, his sense is the properly governed soul is that which is governed by reason. But our souls can go askew and astray if they are governed by desire. And desire can be tyrannical. Here's Plato's way of saying it, and it fits with what Paul is saying here too. Plato says, quote, "Just as a community enslaved to a tyrant cannot do what it really wishes, so neither can a soul under a similar tyranny do what it wishes as a whole. Goaded on against its will by the sting of desire, it will be filled with confusion and remorse. Like the corresponding community, it must always be poverty-stricken, unsatisfied, and haunted by fear. Nowhere else will there be so much lamentation, groaning, and anguish as in a country under a despotism and in a soul maddened by the tyranny of passion and lust. It cannot be otherwise." And the Jewish contemporary, or basically contemporary, of Paul, Philo, says this about desire. Again, quote unquote, "Desire is the passion to which name originator of evil can truly be given." And so there again, you see, we have this sense of desire. Now, what is Paul's notion of desire that is going on here? Again, in the history of interpretation of this passage, particularly for Augustine and Middle Ages, and we still have this legacy, and I think inappropriate, quite frankly, that desire meant involuntary sexual desire, which again kind of brings up another diatribe, which we won't go into. Somebody else in a different session can do that. The famous question, is sex sin? To which the appropriate answer is, no, but you cannot enjoy it. Man, why the laughter? That's a serious answer. The notion there is sexuality was only for procreation, and procreation is serious stuff. And of course, if there is any pleasure that goes with it, that of course is the desire, and that's sin. "Thus, in sin did my mother conceive me." Wow, I finish it. I don't know. Right? But that's the whole. From Augustine right into the Middle Ages again, right? desire was seen as always sexual desire and even involuntary sexual desire. Kind of again, like that fruit, right? You're just there minding your own business and whoo, there's a hot one that just went past. That's the issue. So it's all desire. Now, from Luther onward, this notion of desire was interpreted in many, many different ways. Let me give you an interpretation which I think fits here and one that at least I prefer. And again, it is indeed not the only one. But this interpretation here is that this desire is understood as the desire or the passion to assert oneself against God and the neighbor. It is the desire to assert oneself or one's group at the expense of others. It's reflective, I think, again, in Paul's context of the notion of the competitive environment going on within the Greco-Roman and Jewish culture. Again, always wanting to be better than the other person or the other community. So that coveting or desire here is that need to have, to possess, to acquire in order to secure one's being and one's worth. And we can use that sense of desire, that competitiveness in all sorts of different ways, even kind of negative ways and pietistic ways. Some of you from years back may have heard this before, but indeed, right, one of my favorite hymns is "Chief of Sinners Though I Be, Everyone Else Is Worse Than Me." Right? That's desire at work. Right? I want to be, I will be, I am better than all of you. Oh, but of course, I am the chief of sinners. But you're all worse. Remember, you're miserable. And so what Paul is getting us to think about here, right, and this is a sense of admonition and warning to the faithful, and to the faithful communities in Rome, is don't let this competitive environment within either your Greco-Roman or Jewish culture infiltrate your faith communities. Got any desire at work in your faith community? Anybody? Want to talk about that a minute? Any desire? Any desire at work here at Holden? No? Okay, now that we all know you're liars, how about that?
Well, right? The desire is legion up here, so.
Yeah.
And it is for all of our. It can take so many different forms. I mean, one of the things, right, the ironic and again, stupid things is, of course, we all know that with regard to churches and that, right, you know, in terms of church growth and all of that, numbers don't count. We're not just interested in numbers. But of course, whenever you have to fill out a parochial report, what's the first question they want to know? Baptized membership, confirmed membership. Give us the numbers.
And worship attendance.
And worship attendance and Sunday school attendance. needs. And of course, therefore, our desire is, maybe even if it's not to be the biggest congregation around, we're certainly going to have the best Sunday school or the best worship or the best music program or the best whatever. And we're certainly better than Our Lady of Perpetual Guilt down the street. That's that competitiveness. That's that desire. There's concupiscence, I think, in its greatest form. And so that is what Paul is concerned about. And so, how does sin get into all of this? We'll look at that for a moment, and then we'll call it quits for today. This is in verse 8, where it says there that sin, seizing an opportunity, is I think what it says in the NRSV, and you may have noticed as you followed along, I translated that is that sin, seizing a base of operations. And there again, foremost is a military term. Right? And again, you can see we're kind of using military rights. Sin seizes, sin takes over that territory, right? And a foremost literally was, you know, every army needs to have a base of operations from which it can launch its attack and its campaign. And so here again, sin is campaigning against us. And so therefore, sin seizes a base of operations in order to activate that which it is about. And of course, as crazy as it sounds, the base of operations which sin seizes is the proclamation of the law. Sin uses the law as an instrument, as a means, and my little folksy way of looking at this is basically a puppet in order to bring about death. And so here we go. Here's the Muppet Show, right? This is the law, but of course, sin now seizes the law. And so again, right? Sin seizing the law does things which you may not want to do, like stick your tongue out another's mouth. Right? But sin is controlling the puppet. Sin has, because of its base of operations, seize the law in order to mount its campaign against you. And it's successful. And the result is death. Because after all, when you go to war, you don't mess around. You want the other side, quite frankly, to die. And sin grabs the law in order that we die. And there's no way of being more miserable, I think, than being dead. That's what is happening. Like a hand puppet controlled by the hand that activates it, so the law is controlled by sin, that takes it over and uses it for its own purposes. If the law results in evil acts, one is not to condemn the law, but rather the controlling power that activates and causes such actions. Right. So when little wretched I goes, right, it's not going to do any good to wash this sock out with soap. Because the sock isn't really doing this. It's this, which is, of course, again, what is going to be revealed, but indeed that is only going to be revealed through Christ and the gospel. But that's getting way ahead of ourselves, isn't it? Right now, we've got sin controlling us. Paul had already talked about this in Romans chapter 5, verse 12. Through one man, sin came into the world, and death came through sin. Right. Sin killed me. And so Paul says, again in verse 10, the very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me. Sin reversed the intent of the law and caused it to work death rather than life.
And if chapter?
This is chapter 7, verse 10, is what I'm commenting on. But if we have lots more, we could look at all those wonderful passages in Deuteronomy, for example. But let me go back here and just give you one that you can look up at on your own. This is Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 to 20, which is, you know, Moses is about to die, so to make sure everybody gets things straight, we're going to do the law one more time. The second time. Deuteronomy. And again, what happens there is God makes a promise. And really, is it a promise or not? We could talk about that too. But let's say God makes a promise that basically, keep Torah and you shall live. Good, right? You can find that all over the place in Deuteronomy, but elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible as well. But here now, note, it's reversed. Right? Sin, now controlling the law, works death rather than life. Sin, activating the law, leads us to depend on ourselves and on our moral achievements rather than on God and God's gracious promise in Christ. Sin has not used something evil, but something good to work its evil intent. And that's the really deceptive and tricky thing about sin. It never uses bad stuff. Right? It never uses things like broccoli to have you gain weight. It uses ice cream. And worse, when you come to Holden, it gives you Holden Scoops ice cream. Right? Sin works with the good stuff, never with the bad stuff, because it wouldn't deceive us then. We We may be stupid, but we're not that stupid. And again, think back to Genesis 3:6. The human beings were tempted not by, oh, let's eat a prickly pear cactus. Yeah. It was fruit that looked good and gave delight and was what we desired. Sin knew how to work. It picks the good stuff. And that's what happens here too. It uses the law, which indeed is good, Paul has no argument with that, to work its evil. And of course, what sin does to the law, it does to us. It takes us, good creatures of God that we are, creatures created in the image of God, and enslaves us to its own evil purposes. Sin uses the law it has corrupted, and in turn, sin uses us, so that God's good creation can no longer do the good it wants to do and knows it should do. And this is what Paul goes on to talk about in chapter 7. And so what Paul is talking about here is not a moral dilemma. If only it were that simple. The way out of a moral dilemma is to learn better, to know the good, and try harder. If you want to work your way out of a moral dilemma, take one of my courses and we'll read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and you can figure out what to do. Not a problem. This is a problem. The tragedy here is that sin has enslaved us, imprisoned us, turned us into puppets. Passage is not simply about good or bad intentions and about how we feel, but it speaks about our actions, what we do and how they are all constrained and confined within the tyranny of sin. And that's what makes you miserable. Thank you. If you have questions or what, I'll be happy to talk with folks after class, or we can bring them up tomorrow, because tomorrow we will continue our misery. So.